Accuracy errors or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the American Federation of Government Employees Inside Government Program, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power. Now, here's your host, Jason Fornicola.
This week, we'll discuss sequestration's impact on the Department of Housing and Urban Development with AFGE Council 222 President Eddie Eiches and the Department of Defense with Local 2142 President Joe Gonzalez. We'll also be joined by Bureau of Prisons Local 1112 Representatives Mike Schnobrick and April Bennett, and Transportation Security Administration Local 778 Executive Vice President Bobby Newsom. With me now, Eddie Eiches, the President of AFGE Council 222. Eddie, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Eddie, sequestration continues to dominate the headlines. What's the impact on your agency, the Department of Housing and Urban Development?
We have a budget of approximately $40 billion. Of that budget, $38.7 billion are in programs, and $1.3 billion are in salaries and expenses. The program side of HUD will be taking about a $2.2 billion hit, and on the S&E side, it will be $63 million. So you see that the vast majority of the effect of sequestration on HUD will be on programs.
That sounds significant, Eddie. Have you been able to go over the numbers and learn what might have to be cut from the program side?
Sure. For example, about 125,000 individuals and families, including elderly and disabled individuals, could lose assistance provided through the housing voucher program and be at risk of being homeless. Sequestration cuts would also result in more than 100,000 formerly homeless people, including veterans, being removed from their current housing or emergency shelter programs, putting them at substantial risk of becoming homeless. Sequestration cuts to the Housing Opportunities for Persons with AIDS program would result in 7,300 fewer low-income housing households receiving permanent and short-term supportive housing assistance, including rent or utility assistance. There'll be effects on Indian Country, too. Lead-based paint will be harmed. More than 3,000 vulnerable children would not be protected from lead poisoning and other safety hazards in the family. Sequestration would result in 75,000 fewer households receiving foreclosure prevention, pre-purchase rental, or counseling through HUD's housing counseling programs. The impact of sequestration would force public housing authorities to defer maintenance and capital repairs to public housing, leading to deteriorating living conditions and, over the longer term, risking the permanent loss of this affordable housing that serves 1.1 million of the nation's poorest residents. Even Hurricane Sandy relief would be affected because Congress appropriated community development and other funds for the recovery and building of the devastation, and the March 1st sequestration would force cuts to these critical funds, preventing communities from making critical investments. And then we also for sure have the salary and expense side of this.
Eddie, I just want to recap a couple of things that you mentioned here of some of the population that's going to be affected. Low income, disabled, formerly homeless veterans, vulnerable children. These are groups that are clearly in need of these services. What's your reaction to these cuts?
Well, sadly, I mean, it's devastating. The cuts are absolutely devastating. And this is not a group that knows how to lobby politically. It's not a group that is super organized. It's not like big business, and their message obviously is not being heard, at least among a segment of the House of Representatives.
So what can be done then to stand up for these individuals who rely on these services?
Well, we have to get some type of deal. I mean, some you know, we understand that March 1st is a magic date for sequestration. And but March 27th is even more important, and that is March 27th is the date that the continuing resolution ends. We won't be funded. This is just the beginning of super harm to the most vulnerable Americans it's unreal. HUD will be closed down on March 27th unless Congress acts.
Eddie, how does that make you feel, not only as an employee of the agency, but one who represents a large number of the workers?
Well, our union has probably been, on some level, unique within AFGE in that we've always focused on the mission of the agency as well as working conditions. We lobbied during the Bush administration to stop community development block grants from being devastated by that administration. Our people are really tied to the mission. We believe in the mission, and for sure, you know, we will be affected and it will hurt. But we also really, all of the work that we've done, and I've been a HUD employee since 1978, seen all of that work almost, you know, the fear of that work just going down the tubes.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're here with Eddie Eiches, the president of AFGE's Housing and Urban Development Council 222. Eddie, you mentioned earlier that the individuals who rely on these services from HUD aren't particularly a group that lobby on their own behalf or may not speak up on their own behalf. Have you been able to speak to anyone who's relying on these services? And if so, what have they said to you about their thoughts on the cuts?
We've been involved with the coalitions and not necessarily individuals, and we're doing the best we can do. It will be devastating. I mean, to see everybody thrown out of homeless shelters that are funded in this fashion, or to see, you know, I mean, the pain that, you know, we fought so hard to get the relief for Hurricane Sandy, and then to see some of that cut back, it's absolute lunacy to know that all of these cities will be affected too, and that is subsidized housing will be cut. It's a complete disaster. I mean, you can't help but drive, you know, I mean, I drive past public housing projects where maintenance will not take place.
Eddie, are there areas around the country that could be hit harder than others because of these cuts?
I would think that obviously the areas where we're most used, that is the areas probably suffering most from from the recession and not getting super hyped in as to the recovery. Yeah, those would. But it's a lot of urban areas. It's the poorest of the poor. It's the social safety net that we're just rejecting. That instead of acting in some way to stop this. This outrageous action. We're just sitting back and saying, well, we'll see how much they suffer.
You mentioned that you've been a HUD employee since 1978. Can you remember at any time during your career a situation as serious as this one?
Yeah, I can remember 1995 when the House was instrumental in closing down the government.
And this is a similar situation, in your opinion, in terms of the critical nature of the situation?
I think that was more serious, but I think when we get if we don't get resolution by March 27th, it will be very, very similar.
Eddie, let's talk a little bit about your relationship, working relationship with management at the Housing and Urban Development Department. You have mentioned in the past that you're able to get a lot of things done on behalf of the workers. Can you talk to me about some of those things you've been able to achieve by having a good relationship with management?
Well, for sure, we try to engage in all types of pre-decisional discussions. And we never give up our right to formally bargain, but we do a lot of that. We were, the first agency to sign a transit subsidy memorandum of understanding. Some might say, well, we were dealing with dollars. And probably we were, but still the agency signed it. And transit subsidies is really such a critical benefit because it's pre-tax money. So now that the amount will go from 120 to 245 per the legislation, you know, recently passed, we will have that implemented. So, I mean, the significance it cannot be underestimated. It will be, you know, close to $4,800. Which after taxes could be, you know, almost $6,000. So then if you're dealing with an employee making $60,000, it's actually 10% of that employee's salary. I mean, it's absolutely critical. So we work together to find a way, despite the cuts to salaries and expenses, so that we would be able to implement the transit subsidy not only in the D.C. area, which we would argue it's required pursuant to an executive order, but throughout the country. We have been involved in pre-decisional discussions for the last few months on how sequestration would affect HUD employees. So we've now gone from the possibility of 13 furlough days to at most 7, and we think we can actually compress that amount. I have been invited, at least occasionally, not all the time, but to the principal staff meeting, where the secretary will actually report on what takes place during cabinet level meetings.
Eddie, as we close out here today, if our listeners want to learn more about your work on the council at the Department of Housing and Urban Development, how can they find you all?
Well, we have a website. You can just search it, you know, HUD AFG or AFG Council 222. We also have a local website, www.afge476.org.
Eddie Eiches, the president of AFGE's Housing and Urban Development, Council 222. Eddie, great having you on the program today. Thanks for stopping by.
Thank you so much.
You are listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll discuss sequestration's impact on DOD civilian workers with AFGE Local 2142 President Joe Gonzalez.
Attention AFGE members. Are you in need of a new computer or home appliance but can't spare the upfront cash? Discover Purchasing Power, an exclusive benefit that allows you to buy brand name electronics, furniture, and more through easy payroll allotment. With no upfront cash or credit check required and 12 months to pay, Purchasing Power gives you a better way to buy. AFGE members receive an 8% discount over what other federal employees pay. Learn more at afge.org/purchasingpower.
Planning a family vacation? Did you know through your AFGE membership, you are eligible for discounts for you and your family when you travel to Busch Gardens, Adventure Island, Knott's Berry Farm, SeaWorld, and Universal Studios? And if you enjoy winter activities, take advantage of discount lift tickets for New England ski resorts. These are just some of the benefits offered by the American Federation of Government Employees, the nation's largest federal workers union, representing some 600,000 workers nationwide. AFGE also offers members a host of other valuable benefits, from scholarships and insurance to discounts on computers, appliances, health clubs, and more. AFGE is the largest and most influential federal and D.C. government employee union in the United States. If you are a member, simply go to the AFGE website and click on the Member Benefits tab or call 888-844-2343. Not a member? Become one. Go to afge.org and click on the Join AFGE Today button on the homepage. AFGE, proud to make America work.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Joe Gonzalez, president of AFGE's Local 2142 out of Corpus Christi, Texas. Joe, welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much.
Joe, in addition to being the president of 2142, you're also the chair of AFGE's Hispanic Coalition, a very significant and important part of AFGE. Talk to me about the latest at HISCO.
The latest right now in HISCO, of course, is trying to persuade a lot of the members up on the Hill about the importance of immigration reform. I have had several meetings, not only with my local congressional representatives, but I've also been meeting with a lot of the other groups like LACLA, IMAGE, along the way, American GI Forum, all the Hispanic-type groups that support and want to see a good immigration reform bill come out this year out of this House of Representatives.
When you go to your representatives and you talk to them about your concerns and your ideas, how do they respond?
It all depends. We try to give them the understanding that we're there to represent not only those constituents within their districts or within their states, but the importance of what we represent as federal employees throughout the United States and overseas. I think that in most cases, once you've put that particular words to them, they tend to listen. They you grab their attention. And of course, that's the whole key in coming up here to Washington, is knowing those key words that will open that door and that interest for that House representative or that senator to take the time and sit down. Even the staffers, if you hit them in the right way with the words, they will listen to us.
Talk to me about some of your main points that you're trying to get across to the people.
The Hispanic Coalition within AFGE, of course, is diverse. We represent everyone. You don't have to be Hispanic to be part of HISCO. HISCO represents, you know, a tremendous different type topics, everything from discrimination to labor type of cases. Recently, of course, we had a situation where an illegal immigrant had been employed by the federal government. And it was interesting to find out, because the federal government right now punishes people that hire illegal immigrants. We took this case because it was interesting to find that the father of this particular case also had two sons in Iraq. DLA, logistical agency, hired this individual, and then later on, after he had passed probation, came back and found that in his application, he had marked that he was not a legal citizen. So they wanted to question him. He came to me as president of his school to see what we could do for him. He was scared. He was being intimidated. He was being coerced. Of course, at that time, during the moment, I had other business that I had to attend to. Now, I left town. When I came back, they had gotten him so scared, he ran off. He quit. Later on, I caught up with the gentleman, and we talked about the importance of his service, being that he had two sons serving in Iraq. That really touched my heart. I said, I got to be able to do something for them. Of course, with the other agencies that I've worked with Image and LULAC, we got together and we were able to get him through the classes and made him a legal citizen of the United States. I went back and I talked to the generals within the Defense Logistics Agency, and I was able to get him again back into civil service, reinstated, and got him all his back pay and benefits that he had lost. What really touched my heart is when one of the sons came back from Iraq, he came back and made it a point to come to my office. I'll never forget that. It's such a good feeling. And for us as labor, those are very far and in between. It's not every day that you get a good feeling. You want that feeling of being able to accomplish something, and we did.
In your opinion, is this almost a typical day in the life of a labor leader?
Yes, it is. I can tell you, my days start at 5 o'clock in the morning there at my agency, and I represent there at the in the Corpus area, not only the Corpus Christi Army Depot, but I also have the DLA, I've got TMDE, AMCOM, and I've got the contracting center. So it's interesting, right from the start of the day, I usually have probably four or five people waiting for me at 15 till 5 for me to open the office, because we've got shift work. We got first, second, and third shift. So I try to make sure that we always have a coverage of all the shifts for the people. If nothing else, to listen, to be a good listener.
Joe, this is certainly a challenging time for federal employees. And, of course, you and all of your folks are here this week at AFGE's Legislative and Grassroots Mobilization Conference to take some of your messages and ideas up to Capitol Hill. As it relates to sequestration, what are your thoughts on how it could impact your folks at Corpus Christi?
Serious, very serious impact. When you stop to think the possibility of losing 22 days of employment, you start adding up the hours of 22 days times 8, that's a lot of hours of pay that will be out of people's pockets. I can tell you, as a single parent, it's very important for us to understand that, you know, most of us live paycheck to paycheck. What might happen, and hopefully it doesn't, they can very well put our members or our bargaining units, people, in positions where rent's not going to be able to be paid for that particular month. You're not going to be able to do your payments toward your car. Just a tremendous amount of effects that can come out of this. And of course, you know, all of us always want that good credit score. You know, so what happens in these type of situations? What will develop? I hope that the Congress, and I talk to all the members of Congress, do the right thing. Pass the budget. We're the eyes and ears for the taxpayers. And as a taxpayer, I know the importance of our obligations, and the government does too. And they need to step up to the plate and do the right thing and pass this budget. I can tell you that there in Corpus, a lot of turnarounds as far as age group. My agency used to be the average age 55 years of age. With the new hires that have been coming on, and of course the retirement age slowly turning around the workforce, we have now gone from 55 years of age on the average down to 47. So gradually it's coming down. And those young kids need that assurance. They need to be able to say, you know what, I want to serve my country, and this is one way that I'm able to do that. But when you start looking at the effects that these type of concepts affect us, who wants to go work for that kind of company? And you know, you want to keep those good people. You want them to be able to serve. But if you keep putting obstacles in front of them, especially obstacles that people don't quite understand the impact and the effects that it has, you put in a very serious situation in the people's household. And as working families across this nation, I can tell you, as a federal employee, I'm one of those families.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're here with Joe Gonzalez, the president of AFGE's Local 2142, as well as the chair of AFGE's Hispanic Coalition. Joe, it sounds like you're genuinely concerned about the federal government's ability to recruit and retain the best and brightest that the country has to offer.
You're absolutely right. You know, we're not out of the war yet. We're still performing out in Afghanistan. The Corpus Christi Army Depot is the only helicopter facility within the Department of Defense. In fact, it's the only helicopter repair facility in the world in a military installation. So we see the effects and the importance of what that soldier needs out in the field. As we look down the road, and this question comes hopefully not to reality, but could become a reality, what's going to happen to those poor soldiers out there? Who will they be able to depend on to make sure that they're being provided the equipment and the needs out in the field?
Many times when we talk about the impact that cutbacks would have, furloughs, if you will, we certainly discuss the impact on the federal employee in his or her life. And we also discuss the impact on public service, which is significant. But in this case, the public service that's being delivered is the war effort. It's national security, right?
Absolutely. It's only, how should I say, means that that soldier has available to him to make sure that he's in contact with his family here back in the United States. I can tell you that most recent, we made efforts during the Christmas holidays to send packages out to the soldiers, especially in the agency that we're in. We deal with aviation, so we wanted to make sure that the pilots and the crews, the maintenance crews, all had a little bit of home during the holidays. So we send out packages to them with cookies and candies and stuff. So, you know, not only do we provide the service and repair and modification of the helicopters, but we also take it personal. And on that particular basis, we make sure that their needs and wants are met.
Joe, we mentioned earlier that you are, of course, here in town for AFGE's annual legislative conference. As you make your way up to Capitol Hill with your members, what message are you trying to impress most upon Congress?
It's time to step up to the plate. All of us in public service want to do the right thing for our constituencies. This is the right thing. Pass the budget. Don't play the party thing, the party line anymore. This is serious stuff. You're going to affect millions of people's livelihood if you don't step up to the plate. I can tell you that I will be visiting not only within my state, but I'll be visiting every military appropriation representative out there, along with depot caucus committees, in making sure that they understand exactly the services that we as federal employees within the Department of Defense serve for that soldier in the field. And they could very well jeopardize or circumvent what's going on right now in Afghanistan.
Joe Gonzalez, the president of AFGE's Local 2142 and the chair of AFGE's Hispanic Coalition. Joe, great to have you on the show, as always.
Thank you so much. As always, I really enjoy coming out here and talking to my brothers and sisters throughout this country and letting them know that AFGE is here to serve all of us. And without you all, we can't make it.
Great to see you, Joe. Thanks for coming by.
Thank you. God bless.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll address health services concerns in the Bureau of Prisons with AFGE Local 1112 Representatives Mike Schnobrick and April Bennett.
Attention AFGE members. Are you in need of a new computer or home appliance but can't spare the upfront cash? Discover Purchasing Power, an exclusive benefit that allows you to buy brand name electronics, furniture, and more through easy payroll allotment. With no upfront cash or credit check required and 12 months to pay, Purchasing Power gives you a better way to buy. AFGE members receive an 8% discount over what other federal employees pay. Learn more at afge.org/purchasingpower.
Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, WFED.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We have two representatives from AFGE's Bureau of Prisons Local 1112, Mike Schnobrick, the president, and April Bennett, the steward. Mike and April, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Nice to be here.
We are here today, of course, at AFGE's Legislative and Grassroots Mobilization Conference. The two of you have a very unique situation going on in your local related to health and safety in the Bureau of Prisons. Tell me a little bit about that.
One of the issues that we're having with, I know it's nationwide with the Bureau of Prisons, is there's such a staffing shortage within the medical departments, particularly with within our local. What we're seeing is we're having difficulty retaining or actually recruitment with clinicians. That would be your physicians, mid-level providers who are physicians, assistants, and nurse practitioners, as well as registered nurses. So the inability to recruit these guys and then retain them is huge.
April, if they're not coming to work for the Bureau of Prisons, where are they going to work?
Well, they're working within the private sector. One of the reasons why we're having difficulty is they're hiring these folks at, for example, registered nurses are being hired at GS-7s. That's an entry-level position. When prior practice, they were GS-10s. They can come to work off the street from school in a private sector, like at your local hospital, nursing home, and they can make $60,000. Within the Bureau of Prisons, it's about $15,000 less.
Why make the shift from a GS-10 to a GS-7?
You know, the only thing that I can think of that they're trying to do is cost-saving measures, but in actuality, it's creating an even greater issue within the Bureau of Prisons, and that's related to patient care. And when we start looking at inmate medical care, you're looking at bigger issues related to their civil rights, not receiving basic medical care.
How much of this impacts the inmate and the care that he or she receives?
It's a great impact. It's huge. Right now, we're at critical staffing levels within our local in Colorado. And what that means for inmates is they're not receiving your basic medical care. So our staff could be missing serious medical issues that over a period of 10 months a year they're not getting basic medical care. So what happens with that is they end up going out to an outside hospital. So you got to look at the issues we have there. We look at the safety of the public, staff safety, everything's involved. Plus it's a greater cost to send those inmates out to a local hospital than it is to give them basic medical treatment within inside of the institution. But we can't provide that to them because we don't have enough staff to provide it, because our hands are tied being able to hire people at the levels that they should. But the outcome of that is going to be multi-million dollars of lawsuits to the agency and to taxpayers in essence.
Mike, if they're not getting the proactive care that they need at the early stages of a disease or an illness, what kind of care are they getting in the long term?
Yes, it actually happens in several different levels. It's like any other kind of health care. If you can get it taken care of early, it's much cheaper, it's easier to get done. But also in a prison environment, especially in a high-security prison environment like we have in Florence with the administrative maximum and high-security penitentiary, it also makes it much more complicated because of the security levels. So it's not just taking an inmate to the hospital, it's taking the inmate to the hospital with all the necessary security processes that have to go with it, which means it's even more expensive in order to deliver health care to inmates when you're not getting treatment in an earlier stage than it would be out on the private sector.
What are your members saying about this?
They feel that what it does is it creates a very difficult work environment for all the staff in the facility. Inmates, when they have problems with their health care issues, it puts a burden on the entire system. It affects the correctional services staff in the day-to-day operations that they're involved with. It affects the way that the inmates relate to the staff. It becomes a much more hostile work environment. In fact, one of the problems that you have in administrating prisons is that they're very delicate and balanced organizations, and one part isn't functioning correctly, it has very negative effects throughout the entire system. So even if you could isolate the cost to just health care, you really are missing the bigger picture. It impacts everything from injuries from staff assaults that can turn into long and drawn-out workers' compensation plans, early retirement issues because of PTSD issues. The list just goes on and on and on. So basically what we're finding ourselves in right now is that some of the things that's going as far as budget and staffing is concerned is we're being very penny-wise, but we're being very dollar-foolish. We're going to end up costing more money the way we're currently going than if we just do it the right way.
I think you make a great point about one area of the prison impacting another, because maybe in like no other situation in a federal prison, you really are all in it together.
Yes, we are a team, the entire from the wardens on down.
So then what can be done to combat this situation?
One thing that we need to do is we need to have Congress take a serious look at this situation. One of the problems that we're seeing is that there really is no comprehensive way of reporting to Congress and to other oversight groups what's actually happening. And so the only time that we ever find out about these things is when it's already gotten to the point where we're looking at multi-million dollar lawsuits or other major meltdowns. And I think we need to find ways to be more proactive to get ahead of the power curve.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're here with two representatives from AFGE's Bureau of Prisons Local 1112, Mike Schnobrick, the president, and April Bennett, a steward. April, I understand that there is a use of some public health service personnel in this situation. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Yeah, public health service is actually a uniformed service, a paramilitary, if you will. The only problem that we have with public health service, specifically within my local now, is the public health service they provide medical care. I know they're utilized in other federal agencies, but particularly with the Bureau of Prisons, they should be used for direct patient care, which would be direct inmate care. However, they're not being used for that. They're being placed in administrative positions, folks who run the institution. So, for example, the shortage that we're experiencing now within our local of medical staff and clinicians, which is not affording the inmates their basic civil right, the inability to properly staff our institution. We have positions where people are in administrative jobs, which they could be providing direct patient care. That's, of course, just a Band-Aid to the bigger picture. However, the problem with public health services is when you look at the salary comparison compared to what staff in a standardized position description or standardized position, for example, a GS-11 starting pay is going to be approximately $57,000. A GS-05 or PHS-05, public health services, if you will, 05 billet or 06 billet is going to be making six figures. So we're not saving the taxpayers any money in that aspect. It would be makes more sense to me if we just hired bargaining unit employees.
What are your staffing levels like at FCC Florence?
Right now we're at 39%, and that 39% meaning those are the folks who provide direct inmate patient care or medical care.
So what happens day in and day out whenever you're only staffed at 39%?
Well, let me just give you an example. When one of the prisons opened up, they had approximately six mid-level providers, which is a physician's assistant. I think it was six to nine. Right now we have one. So we have one mid-level provider at each institution trying to provide basic medical care for over 3,500 inmates. So if you look at the policies that the Bureau has written, it's not even conducive with the staffing levels that they tell us that we need to have. So what they're having to do, instead of running direct medical care, running sick call, taking care of these issues as inmates bring it to their attention, they're basically doing emergency medicine. Because what can happen during the middle of a day, we'll have an emergency, our physician assistant has to stop what he or she is doing to go tend to this emergency. And one of the other issues, like I said earlier, we can't hire the registered nurses, which gives us that second line of medical care like you would in any normal doctor's office. We can't hire them because we can't competitively give them a salary that they could get outside. So day-to-day operations, for an example, one of the institutions, they're over probably close to 500 behind in sick call. And if you look at how that works, your sick call is done on a daily basis. Usually they will triage the medical complaints by the inmates and prioritize and see them according to medical need. However, what happens being that far behind is they continue to get more behind because they keep coming in. They keep having to stop and take care of emergency situations. So again, that becomes a safety issue of all staff. The correctional officers who are managing these inmates in the housing units, they're the ones who are going to be dealing with the disruption, with the staff assaults, having feces thrown at them, urine thrown at them, and potentially serious assaults that could result in death. So we're looking at those issues, and then you look at the medical staff are concerned about their licenses because they can't provide basic medical care. So when these inmates begin to sue, which they will, there'll be multi-millions of dollars worth of lawsuits, and our medical staff are terrified of losing their medical license because of this.
Mike, we've talked at great length over the years about the safety concerns in the Bureau of Prisons, and many times correctional officers are tasked with supervising as many as 150 inmates at one time, oftentimes more. We've seen from that situation outbreaks of violence because there's only one officer charged with supervising so many inmates. The situation that April is detailing here with such low staffing levels, is there a concern of violence towards the health professionals as well because of the low staffing levels?
Yes, actually, inmates, when they get to a certain situation where they're having these kinds of problems, they don't have the option to go to the particular person they might be angry with. They have to deal with who's in front of them. And that's the reason why all of us get affected by this sort of a thing in a prison situation. They don't just direct their anger in one direction. They direct it at everybody. And so the correctional officers will have to deal with that sort of a pent-up anger and frustration by the inmates, as well as even the chaplains or the education specialists. In other words, it's so disruptive throughout the entire system that you can't say just one group of people are more negatively affected than others. Everybody has to deal with this.
So as you make your way up to Capitol Hill this week to talk to your legislators, what are you trying to impress upon them?
We're actually, everything that we've talked about with you, we're pressing upon them from the low staffing levels to competitive salaries to the potential lawsuits, even all the way to basic civil rights of inmates. Because when you look at it, all of these issues encompassed, it's going to result in serious, serious dollars that are spent by taxpayers to remedy the situation. So like what we talked about, being penny wise and dollar foolish, that's really what it boils down to. Because if we don't give some competitive salaries to these registered nurses or mid-levels or physicians, for that matter, at the forefront, we're not going to be able to retain them. So the end result, again, is the lack of medical care, which infringes on civil rights, and then it results in serious lawsuits, which will affect every taxpayer, and it's already happening right now.
Is there a way to implement fixes now, today, that would alleviate the situation, or is this something that needs to be thought out a little longer?
Well, one of the quick fixes, because we've really thought about this process, is we really need to, as far as recruitment and retention, we need to go back to direct hiring by our local human resources as opposed to going through Grand Prairie, because that process can take up to 8 months. And by the time that we do a condition of employment offer to these clinicians, they've already accepted a job somewhere else. So we're kind of shooting ourselves in the foot as far as the forefront of that. The other issue is we can utilize the public health services for direct medical care. That's not going to cost anybody anything right now. And the same with the human resources aspect of that. And we got to conform to the staffing models that the Bureau of Prisons actually gave us, that they're not they're not following. So we need to follow those. We've talked great length about a lot of the hiring regulations too. We need to look at those as well. Those are proposals that we could do that's not going to cost anything. Now, the other issue too is we've talked about, Mike and I, utilizing what facilities we have now. For example, it could cost up to $6,000 to $10,000 to send an inmate out to do, let's say, a colonoscopy. We've got areas that we could take monies or funding and create these environments within the prison and have these guys come in to do the surgeries. For one, we're not sending these guys out to the public, so we're looking at the safety of the public. We're still going to have to pay physicians' fees and anesthesia for those, but we're cutting costs as far as it would be to pay, like, facility fees, which is horrendous in monies that we're spending out for these inmates. So, but that's what we're seeing. That's what we're doing now, is we're having to send these guys to outside places just to get basic medical care. So those are some issues that we could look at.
AFGE, Bureau of Prisons, Local 1112, President Mike Schnobrick and Steward April Bennett, both of you, thank you for coming on the program today.
Thank you.
Thanks,
Ross.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll take a closer look at AFGE's collective bargaining agreement with the Transportation Security Administration, with Local 778 Executive Vice President Bobby Newsom.
Attention AFGE members. Did you know about AFGE's service to assist you with legal rights issues? It's called the AFGE Legal Rights Attorney Program. It offers free attorney representation in cases brought by AFGE councils and locals on behalf of AFGE members. The program's administered by AFGE's General Counsel's Office. It's handled more than 700 cases since 2005 and won millions of dollars in back pay for its members. In each of the last 2 years alone, AFGE attorneys have brought in more than $1 million in attorneys' fees. Their attorneys are experienced litigators and committed to the best possible representation. The Legal Rights Attorney Program is designed to take cases that will be brought to arbitration, the Merit Systems Protection Board, or other review boards where both back pay and attorney's fees are available. These cases include removal, suspension, reduction in pay, reduction in grade, and furlough. For more information about the program, please call 202-639-6424. Not a member? Become one and take advantage of this incredible resource today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Bobby Newsom, the Executive Vice President of AFGE's TSA Local 778 out of Detroit, Michigan. Bobby, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for having me, Jason. How are you today?
Great, Bobby. Tell me a little bit about what's happening at Local 778.
At Local 778, we have created an executive board. All this is brand new. We just have our contract ratified on December 9th, and we are working on trying to just get that organization started from the ground level. At this point, I mean, we have vice presidents in most of the areas. Most people don't understand that in the TSA, the way that some of the unions are going, is we actually, as a local, cover all 17 airports in Michigan, which includes going up to Iron Mountain. It's 600 miles away. We're trying to structure it to where we can get a lot of time with other people. Problem is airport management, or whatever you want to call it, or TSA management wants to say, you know, hey, we're not going to give you the time for that. You're going to have to do that stuff on your own. So we've done a lot of legwork on the side. But appreciate the fact that we are definitely a part of AFGE. The backing that we've gotten for the last 10 years is incredible. Absolutely incredible. And, you know, we're just doing baby steps. I work real closely with Vaughn Glenn, who is a local president, and he works real closely with Dorothy right behind me. So,
how important is it, Bobby, that you have a contract now?
I think it is incredibly important. Has it been exactly utilized so far? Probably not. It is a first contract. People have to understand that. It's not a second contract. It's not a third. It's not a fourth. It's a first contract that's ever been done with TSA. So are there some little loopholes that they're able to exhaust? Yeah. But in the same respect, without the contract, I mean, a lot of things have happened in a positive way. You know, shift trades, things like that. You can't beat it. So the whole idea is this is a stepping stone for greatness in the future.
How has management received you as union members now with a contract in hand?
I want you to know that communication in TSA's management has to be the most horrendous thing in the world. Because Vaughn and I know everything that's going to happen, like, before they do. We keep trying to impart in them, this is a labor management agreement. This isn't a Bobby and Vaughn agreement with Detroit. This is a labor management contract. You should know this. So, yeah, it's kind of weird, but we do know a lot that's happening in advance. Don't forget, hey, TSA's got lawyers, too. They have that ability to try and just come back with the hammer, and they've been doing it on a regular basis with us. So,
when you look at the details of the contract, what's one or two things that stands out to you that you find to be most beneficial for the membership?
Okay, for the membership as a whole, I think bidding on shifts. We have airports. We have airports in, I believe it was Heidrick's Airport, which was LaGuardia and NYC, that hadn't bid for a shift in 9 years. They walked in the door and they said, okay, you have 2 o'clock to 8 o'clock, or, you know, 2 to 10, Tuesday, Wednesday off. And they've been stuck there for that many years. So when you look at the enormity of what the contract had to cover, I think that the bidding on shifts, the annual leave, and things of that nature, that was probably the hugest amount that you're going to see inside of what that contract did. It's going to make sure that all the 477 airports across the country are on the same page. No longer can you go into Salt Lake City, Utah, and say, hey, I don't want this shift, I want that shift, or can you go into LaGuardia, or can you go into Detroit? It's going to be a combination thing. We were kind of blessed. Some of the things in the contract, obviously, with RFSD being the chief negotiator for management, we did some of these things already. We had been doing these things already. So I think, yeah, when you talk about the biggest thing in the contract, it's got to be easily the shift bid and annual leave process.
With that shift bidding now in the contract, how has that impacted the morale at the agency for those workers?
Now, hey, don't get me wrong. When you're thinking of somewhere like JFK, some of those people were happy that they were in those positions for 7 years. And they don't want to get out if their seniority doesn't hold it. So, I mean, you get a little backlash both ways. But in the same respect, you're making sure that seniority matters. And that's a huge deal. We've never had that ability to say, listen, seniority matters. Someone has been here 10 years, which obviously, you know, when we talk about seniority, like I said, I was from the Postal Service before I came over here. So I'm used to seniority when someone says, yeah, I got 44 years, okay, buddy? I get an all driving route. But with TSA, a lot of people will say, well, I got 10 years of seniority. Yeah, it's not a whole lot. But inside the structure of it, with the people that are 2, 3, 6, 7, 10, we had to have some structure and some way to start it, you know? So I just really push that the seniority matters. You know, is it a day seniority? Yeah, it might be, because there's a lot of people that were hired directly after 9/11 in like a 2-week sporadic thing. So really, some people only have 2 to 4 weeks higher seniority than somebody else. But did they get it hired first? Yes, they did. So that's how it works.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're here with Bobby Newsom, the Executive Vice President of AFGE's TSA Local 778 in Detroit, Michigan. Bobby, you mentioned covering all 17 airports in Michigan. When you are traveling around the state addressing issues, what comes up the most as a concern for the workers?
Concern for the workers is privatization of the airports in the United States. Obviously, when I go to the west side of the state, and myself and Vaughn go to the west side of the state, hey, those are smaller airports. When I mentioned that Iron Mountain Airport, it's got 6 employees for TSA in it. Their fear is that it'll go private. I would say that that's probably number one fear. The other one is complete mismanagement. You have to understand, in that airport of 6 people, it's all officers. There's no management there. Their managers show up once a week. They see them once a week. You know, otherwise, they just run it by themselves. And it's still the pitter-pat, I'm going to get you syndrome that we seem to have, you know, between labor and management. And it's unfortunate as it gets, because I'll tell you what, when morale is down, production's down. When morale is up, production's up. Unfortunately, we don't have a management staff that has that ability to see that, hey, maybe we should take better care of these people. So I think what you see more often is overabundance of discipline and the privatization rule.
Talk to me about the commitment of the workforce, because despite all of these challenges that you are detailing for us here today, TSOs are still charged with ultimately keeping the flying public safe.
You know, one of the quotes I use all the time when I hear some lady say, I'm so scared I haven't flown in 20 years, is I said, you know what, if my mom can't get on the plane, you can't get on the plane. I mean, if it's not safe enough for my mom to fly, I'm not going to fly. Hey, I'm Mr. Union Guy, but I'll tell you what, mission first for me. It's the biggest deal for me in the world. I follow the SOP, and I make sure that when it comes down to it, Anybody that gets on that plane is going to be safe today. I will not have someone go down on my watch. And that's pretty much what you're going to hear out of the 44,000 bargaining unit employees that are available for the for TSA. Is you're going to hear almost every one of them say, mission first. You know, and then that's the deal. Right now, as we speak, I think as of last week, we had 15,000 out of the 44,000 as members of AFGE. Our goal is to try and get somewhere in the 20,000 range by June and 25 by the end of the year. Hey, I think we can do it.
You're, of course, here in town this week for yep. AFGE's Legislative and Grassroots Mobilization Conference. As you make your way up to Capitol Hill, what message are you taking with you to impress upon Congress?
Well, hey, first off, we're going to walk into Benny Thompson's office and tell him thank you. That's the first thing we do. I mean, I'm going to go in there if I can and give him the biggest hug that ever walked and say thank you for your continued support of TSA. If you don't, Benny Thompson has been the man when it comes to that. So that's my first goal. Now, we are going to have to meet with the Senator Camps and some of the ones on the left side of the state. I'm going to really try and push the issue that, hey, listen, we as a state of Michigan, we represent everybody, even on the left side of the state for that matter. And we need you to back TSA's initiatives. We need you to ensure that we don't have private airports going on. You got four or five of the smallest airports on that west side of the state, Kalamazoo, Muskegon, Traverse City, Lansing. Don't let them go private. Privatization makes it unsecure. It's a proven fact. When they did the pilot program for the seven airports that are private right now, they proved that TSA officers, are stronger and better trained and better at their job than private screeners.
Bobby, I know the work that you're doing this week as part of the legislative conference, those results you might not see for months and months.
Absolutely.
Down the road. But if you were able to get one thing out of this week, something immediate, what would that be? What are you hoping to achieve in the short term?
Well, in the short term, I mean, definitely, we want to make sure that privatization is not going to happen. Mr. Murdoch, the president of the local in San Francisco, and I don't know if you've talked to him yet. I mean, that's a perfect example, an absolute perfect example of what we got to defend. I mean, what he was able to pull off, along with the AFG's help, and don't get me wrong, other unions involved as well, was immense. You walked into and told an airport authority what you're going to do, and that doesn't happen. I mean, an airport authority is an entity that even blows my mind, and I'm a pretty intelligent guy. When you talk about an airport authority and what they have in their, you know, their jurisdictional ideas and their what they can do, their powers for that matter, it blows your mind. Detroit has a 100-year contract with Delta that Delta gets to control how many flights go in and out of Detroit. Who writes a 100-year contract? How is that possible? I mean, it's amazing. Nobody writes a 100-year contract. But so I really want to push that. Especially with the guys from the left side of the state, you know, the Camps and things of that nature, that, hey, listen, we've got to say, your family flies through Kalamazoo. Do you want them to be safe or not? Your family flies through Grand Rapids. So that's where I kind of lean as hard as I can.
Bobby Newsom, the executive vice president of AFGE's TSA Local 778. Bobby, great to meet you. Thanks for coming on the program.
Absolutely.
Today.
Thank you so much, Jason. Anytime you need me, I mean, I'm here for you.
Thank you to our guests this week, AFGE Housing and Urban Development Council 222, President Eddie Eiches, Department of Defense Local 2142, President Joe Gonzalez, Bureau of Prisons Local 1112, Representatives Mike Schnobrick and April Bennett, and Transportation Security Administration Local 778, Executive Vice President Bobby Newsom. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and that's The View from Inside Government.
Thank you for listening to Inside Government, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power. WFED Washington, WWFD.